Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. We bring you Mark Bittman this time. Bittman is one of the foremost food writers working today. He has embraced the widest possible definition of what that means, with work that ranges from simple recipes to columns on health and the environment to food politics. He first became a household name through his column in the New York Times. Among his six groundbreaking books, How to Cook Everything is considered the new American Bible of cooking. He regularly appears on the Today Show and has hosted four of his own TV series. At the heart of his work is the contention that how and what we eat has the power to transform our own lives and the fate of our planet. Join me for Mark Bittman here on Literary Arts, the Archive Project.
Well, why don't we just plunge right in? And I'll warn you that it starts very seriously, but there are some moments of levity. If we want to see dramatic improvement in environment, healthcare, employment, poverty, climate change, you get the idea, it could go on. If we want to improve our likelihood of survival, then those who value well-being of the planet and the mental, spiritual, and physical health, not only of human beings, but of other inhabitants, must gain more power. This, of course, is easily said, and it's been said routinely since at least the Age of Enlightenment, but it's not easily achieved. What does a food writer have to do? Well, what business does a food writer have talking about these things? Well, at this point, food has everything to do with this. All you have to do is ask the big questions, which is easy enough since, sadly, I suppose, the only aspect of food that you can discuss without bringing in everything else is how much fun it is to eat. And even that's becoming tainted. You can barely talk about your garden or your supermarket or the food on your table without talking about the failure of government, the dominance of corporations, the breakdown of food security, and so on. And that's what I'm talking about tonight. Why the American diet, corporate power, the reasons people don't like government, the reasons people should want more government rather than less are all part of the same problem. Few people would deny that climate change, energy policy, and agriculture, at least in part, food issues that should be addressed in a comprehensive and intelligent way. Each of these topics is so powerful that changing one changes the others. Worsening climate change affects energy policy and, of course, the food that we grow. Similarly, changes in energy usage affect climate change and agriculture. Allowing the so-called market to determine policy in these arenas has not worked. We're wrecking the environment, our food system is a mess, and we're running out of energy. No matter how much sense it makes to rationalize energy use, rein in climate change, and improve the way that we handle our food system, none of this is going to happen, on a large scale at least, until we have a government that's willing to address these issues. So the 800-pound gorilla, when you're talking about anything that matters, including food, is politics. And that means that food isn't as much fun as it used to be. A democratic food system can only happen in a democracy, but conversely, if we can find our way to get to a democratic food system, we can find our way back to an America that works. It starts with transparency, the right to know, and it continues with reform and control. At best, this is probably a 20-year process. At worst, it ends in a tragedy. Either way, 50 to 100 years from now, we'll all be eating a diet that's largely organic and regional. But the question is whether we get there gracefully or through some kind of bizarre science fiction dystopic collapse. What I'm trying to say, perhaps a little too formally, is that food needs to be sustainable. Sustainable means it can endure. Agriculture is a big experiment right now. How many people can the Earth support? With a well-organized agricultural system, the Earth can support 9 billion people. Without it, the population's going to have to decline, and we may wind up being hunters and gatherers again. Agriculture has only been around for 5,000 years. Humans have been around for 200,000. So roughly 2.5% of our history, we've been playing around with agriculture. We've been playing around with industrial agriculture for 75 years. We don't know whether it works or not. I don't think it does. We need to find something that works better. That's what all of this is about. There are opportunities everywhere to move in the right direction. We can work on a personal food system, our own personal food policy, without any help from anyone. But on the big scale, the big picture, we need help. We can't do it individually. It has to be done collectively. Imagine that an external enemy robbed the U.S. of a large share of its natural resources, polluted its water and land, starved a portion of our population while overfeeding another portion to the point of illness, sowed the seeds of cancer and other environmental diseases, contributed mighty to the degradation of the environment and even the climate, and limited the ability of the country to feed itself in the future. What would you be thinking? War? Revenge? At least outrage. Yet all of that has been done by the current food system, run by mega corporations with way too much support from the federal government. How does that make you feel? Last year, on the first anniversary of the Fukushima tsunami nuclear disaster, the novelist Haruki Murakami said, "Nuclear power plants, which were supposed to be efficient, instead offer us a vision of hell." Substitute industrial agriculture for nuclear power plants, and the statement is equally valid. Like nuclear power, industrial agriculture appeared efficient until it became clear that it was anything but. Now our job is to change it. But we didn't invent industrial agriculture, and we can't uninvent it, at least without help. Government's role is to help us get things done, the kinds of things that we can't do by ourselves. Yet today, half the people on Social Security believe they get nothing from government programs. It's hard not to hate government when you feel it's taking more and giving less. This, of course, is an ongoing strategy by those who want to destroy government. Reduce taxes, which in turn reduces desirable government services. And then once those government services are reduced, you argue that the government isn't doing anything useful, so we ought to reduce taxes again. And then you complain about people who aren't paying taxes. Not incorrectly, people see government as being in bed with corporations, but can we change that? Can corporations be made to behave? You all know, I'm sure, that we have the worst level of income inequality of any Western nation. And that's because the last 30 years or so have seen what amounts to a giant vacuum cleaner sucking money out of the pockets of the less and moderately well-off of this country into those of the best-off. For this, we have to thank corporate strategies and a series of governments that appear to believe that only through corporate growth can we prosper, a ridiculous notion. So, how can people regain the power that's constitutionally ours? How can we get government to help us change the food system? Very tough question. In a minute, I might get to one that I can actually answer. Meanwhile, I will say that the rallying cry for 2012 is to stake out positions that would benefit what used to be called the working class and now goes by the 99%, and to garner enough political will and power to pressure the President and Congress to move resolutely on the issues that matter. That's a tall order, too, and that's one that's of more than passing interest to those who think of themselves as part of the food movement, or the environmental movement, or the Occupy movement, or the foreclosed homeowners movement, or the indebted students movement, or the unemployment movement, or pretty much any movement you can name. It doesn't matter what you call the movements or the people behind them. What matters is forcing the government to act in the interest of the sometimes silent majority rather than its corporate paymasters. That struggle is as old as representative democracy itself. Oddly, the first thing we need help with is defining food. It's an interesting question because we don't think about that much. What is food? I'm going to pause and take off my jacket. This is called suspense. Defining food, right. I have a dictionary. My dictionary says that food is any nutritious substance that people or animals eat or drink, or that plants absorb in order to maintain life and growth. That helps, but it doesn't really help unless you define nutritious. So nutritious food, says in the same dictionary, provides those substances necessary for growth, health, and good condition. Growth, health, and good condition. So food is stuff that provides nourishment, and nourishment causes growth, health, and good condition. If you could bear that phrase in mind for the next half hour or so, I'd appreciate it. If we can define food, we can define non-food. We know that non-food is stuff that doesn't provide health, growth, and good condition. The non-food we consume most of is soda. 7% of our calories come from soda, which leads the beverage marketing people to say only 7% of our calories come from soda. Yet that measly 7 calories is part of what's been directly responsible for what some public health officials are now calling an obesity pandemic. And for those of you who are not public health officials, pandemics are like bad epidemics, worse epidemics. They're global, pan, you know, like universal, demic, whatever demic means. It's not just soda, junk food, non-nutritious food in general. We call this a UFO. It's an unidentifiable food-like object. Unidentifiable food-like objects, and the marketing of junk food to children, the presence of bad food in almost every lunchroom and cafeteria and fast food joint and so-called casual joint in the country, all of this can probably be solved by a carrot and stick program of supporting better food for more people while making it more difficult for people to eat and buy bad food. That is actually the core of this message. We have to make it more difficult for people to buy and eat bad food or non-food, and less difficult for people to buy and eat good food. When you go to McDonald's, the cheeseburger is $1 and the salad is $4. If the cheeseburger were $4 and the salad was $1, that would change the equation for a lot of people. This is a very basic principle of what I'm talking about, or I'll say a very basic illustration. So problem number one is one of consumption. What do we eat? And how do we make public policy that affects the way that we eat? Problem number two, and you know, I think about this a lot, and I have a tendency to try to distill things and synthesize things. It's not unlike the way that I cook. So I will say the big problem can be defined by consumption and production. We need to disincentivize the eating of lousy food or non-food and incentivize the eating of good food. There's a lot of sort of very simple statements woven through here. Sadly, it takes me a long time to get to them, but I do the best I can. Anyway, the second problem, the production problem, is or are the agricultural practices that make this stuff possible. I'm going to name just a couple. The indiscriminate use of chemical fertilizer, which degrades groundwater and soil and uses disproportionate amounts of energy. And then monocrop agriculture, that is the kind of agriculture practiced largely in the Midwest. It's actually duocrop agriculture. It's corn and soybeans. Which also degrades the land, increases global warming, uses disproportionate amounts of water and fertilizer, and provides not real food, but the means to make junk food and industrially produced animals. Among the biggest offenders are what are called CAFOs, or consolidated animal feeding operations. These are the kind of places that you hear about only when there's some gross violation that's taped by some undercover agent for PETA or Mercy for Animals or the Humane Society, And then you see, I don't even want to get into it, but you see bad things happening to nice animals. But since there are actually very few laws governing how we treat animals, these egregious instances, these theoretically isolated instances, are just the red flags that show us the rare occurrences that show us how life actually is for the animals in CAFOs, situations like this. And that brings me to something that I mentioned at the beginning, and that is knowledge. The more you know about what's in your food, the more you know how it's produced, A, the angrier you're going to be, and B, the more likely you are to eat real food than fake food. But in order for you to have that knowledge, we need some transparency. Because, and especially, we haven't established, it'll get better, I promise, we haven't established much of a bond yet, but my guess is that the people here sort of know what's going on. This is what's called preaching to the choir. But we have to get the congregation to get the message too. And this is why California's Prop 37, which is a vote to label foods with GMOs, genetically engineered foods, is so important. And this is a vote that's happening this November 6th, and I've called the most important non-national vote on any ballot, not knowing, of course, every non-national vote there is, but from my perspective. And it's important not because genetically engineered foods are so evil. I think on balance, they probably are not going to make a huge difference in the course of the human race, and they've probably done more harm than good in the few years that they've been around. But on balance, it's hard to say that they're really, really terrible. But because survey after survey, 90% of Americans, when 90% of Americans don't agree on anything, right? 90% of Americans say they want to know whether their food contains genetically modified organisms. And the thing is that the industry is fighting this because once these foods are labeled, people are going to stop buying them. And if people stop buying them, farmers are going to stop planting seeds with them. And thus, the so-called market will have done its work. Now, that's actually not what's going to happen if Prop 37 were to pass. What's going to happen if Prop 37 were to pass is that the makers of processed food, which is about a third of, this is a little off script and it's a little technical, but bear with me for a second, about a third of all genetically engineered crops go to make ethanol, which is stupid anyway, but that's a whole nother story. Well, I mean, it's just, I mean, there's so many opportunities here to go off script. It could be like a Fidel Castro speech. That's probably how Fidel did it, actually. About a third are exported, and about a third go into processed foods. But there's enough non-GMO corn and soybeans, which is basically what processed foods are. There's enough of that non-GMO stuff, so Kellogg's and PepsiCo and blah, 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 the people who buy all this stuff and turn it into Pepsi and breakfast cereal and all this other crap, those people will say, okay, if they're going to make us label this stuff in California, and then the Californians are not going to buy it, we'll just buy non-GMO corn and soybeans and we'll reformulate our products. It's not that big a deal. And that is what's likely to happen. And as we've seen from everything from tobacco legislation to car emissions to air pollution from factories and whatnot, what happens in California happens ultimately everywhere. All of our cars are now formulated because of legislation that happened in California in the 70s and 80s. All of us drive cars that have reduced emissions because the Californians passed those laws. And it's not that California's, you know, it is a nice place and all that, but it's not that it's a magic place. It's that it's 12% of the population of the United States. So you're going to start remanufacturing your stuff for 12% of the population. At that point, you might as well remanufacture it for all of us. So where was I? Right. The market, information, knowledge, letting the market do its work. We can't respond. Without information, we can't make the wise decisions. For example, if I tell you how many antibiotics are used in the raising of a chicken, you might be less likely to buy that chicken. You've all heard about antibiotic resistance, and probably some of you have heard of MRSA, really, really serious diseases that are caused by our continuing, the continuing resistance of the bacteria that affect us to antibiotics that used to work. And one of the reasons they don't work is that 80% of the antibiotics in the United States are given prophylactically to animals. What does prophylactically mean in this case? It means to keep them from getting sick. Well, why do we need that to get sick? Because they're raised in such miserable, lousy conditions that they're given antibiotics to prevent disease. And then those antibiotics also encourage growth. They really only encourage growth because the poor animals are managing to stay alive for a little while longer. So there's an awful lot of antibiotics in that chicken, but we don't really know how much. And we don't really know, you know, we get these inklings of how many antibiotic-resistant germs live on the chicken that we're buying and cooking. But with more information, we would be making wiser decisions, and we'd be buying fewer of those 7 or 7.5 billion chickens we buy each year, almost all of which are raised in miserable conditions. But industrial livestock producers don't want you to see any of that. They want to fill your screens with pictures of happy family farmers raising individual cuddly little animals. And of course, that does happen in maybe 1% of the cases. That doesn't explain at all what things look like. The picture of the feedlot that I showed you before is what things look like. Your hamburger doesn't come from one part of one cow ground like this, the way your grandmother, or at least my grandmother, used to do. Your hamburger comes from dozens of sources. Your hamburger may contain meat from 4 countries, let alone 4 different cows. It's the same with your milk. Your milk is not like some guy's going like this, then they put it in a little cardboard thing and bring it to the store. That isn't how it works. That Pringle potato chip is 30% potato. That yogurt contains as much sugar as that ice cream. That health bar is roughly equivalent to a Snickers. That whole grain cereal is probably no better for you than Frosted Flakes. But because of a deliberate misinterpretation of the freedom of speech, which has so far been supported in many Supreme Court decisions, food marketers are allowed to freely peddle their junk, not only to us, but to our children, without telling the truth. So what happens? Despite your best intentions, the kids bug you for junk, and the addiction, and increasingly it's being discovered that it is an addiction, goes on for another generation. I have to go off talk again for a second here. You know, the problem, I'll go meta off talk. The problem with the talk is that you read it and you read it and you think about stuff and you read things that are related and they all start flying into your poor little brain. And you see things that are very closely related to this stuff. So here's one thing that I've seen that's very closely related to this stuff. I have written about, as everybody who writes about the stuff I write about, the fact that there's too much marketing of junk food to kids on television. Now, in the 70s, you could market junk food to children on television all you wanted, which is to say, if you could sell 20 minutes of junk food marketing in an hour of children's programming, you were free to do that. In the 70s, starting in the 60s and in the 70s, people rose up in arms about that and got the feds to limit the amount of programming the amount of junk food marketing commercials that you could do during an hour of children's programming to another only 10 minutes. So only 10 minutes out of every hour of children's programming can be devoted to selling junk. Only 10 minutes. How many limits do we have on the marketing of junk to children on the internet? Would you care to guess? You could probably all guess at the same time. Zero. Right. Your three-year-old, and we actually on this radio program I did this afternoon, we had a woman who was the mother of a three-year-old. Your three-year-old can take your iPhone or your iPad or her whatever, Pod Touch, or your Android, not to be totally Apple-centric, you know, and log on to games. This is a pre-literate child. So there's no question of rational thought here, right? We all, or many of us, have had three-year-olds, and we've all been three-year-olds. We don't even remember being 3 years old. A little kid can go online, play a little game. The woman today was describing a little, floating in a little canoe down a river of milk dotted with Fruit Loops. These are the kinds of games that are now being marketed to kids, and then the kids being wheeled down the aisle in the supermarket and says, I want Fruit Loops. Very effective, as you can imagine. There are zero limits on that kind of marketing right now. So to try to get back on script and not run more than an hour and a half long, for transparency, we need to change our buying and our eating habits, and we need government regulation. We need not only to eat less junk and more good stuff, we need to demand that the government help us do that. Maybe this is a good analogy. I haven't come up with a better one. It's one thing to tell all of us, wash your hands, because if you wash your hands, you reduce contagious diseases, and that's true. But we still need immunizations, we still need doctors, we still need nurses, and we still need hospitals, and having those things is part of the role of the state. Government's legitimate role in helping people is often overlooked these days. But beyond Social Security and Medicare, which are two pretty popular programs, you might think about smoking regulations, child labor laws, farm worker laws, maybe restaurant worker laws, and simple things like building roads, maintaining police forces, and paying teachers, or even building sewers. Building sewers was probably the biggest public health measure of all time. And it's a very expensive one, but you know what? Thanks to sewers, we have greatly reduced the amount of contagious disease in the world, to the point where right now, chronic diseases, so-called lifestyle diseases, kill more people than contagious diseases. That's why we need government to team with us to prevent corporations from marketing us literally to death with soda and other UFOs. The New York City Big Gulp ban, which I'm sure you've all heard about, is a start, but we need bolder moves than that. We need a soda tax. Now, the arguments against these kind of regulations come mostly from the right, but there really is no right or wrong here. There is no right and left here. There's only right and wrong. We're told, as we almost always are when a progressive public health measure is passed, that this is nanny statism. Tobacco companies said the same thing. We also hear things like, if people want to be obese, that's their prerogative. And that's certainly true. And if people want to ride motorcycles without helmets or smoke cigarettes, that's their prerogative also. But it's the so-called nanny state's prerogative to protect the rest of us from that kind of behavior. Obesity-related health costs, and I have to pause here just for 1 second, forgive me. Obesity is a symptom. Obesity is not really the problem, but to talk about the problems, you have to talk about the results. And the results are best represented by obesity, which causes diabetes and other diseases, and we'll get to that. But obesity is not the problem. Obesity-related healthcare costs about $150 billion a year right now, and that's climbing. Obesity does cause diabetes, it may cause Alzheimer's, and it causes cancer. We're all paying for that stuff, and to loosely paraphrase Oliver Wendell Holmes, your right to harm yourself stops when I have to pay for it. And just as we all pay for the ravages of smoking, we all pay for the harmful effects of Coke, Snapple, and Gatorade. Remember, the definition of food. Sugar-sweetened beverages don't meet that definition any more than beer. Actually, beer is better, but any more than... We'll leave beer out of this. Sure, beer has complex carbohydrates in it. Sugar-sweetened beverages don't meet that definition any more than tobacco, and for that matter, heroin. And they have more in common with these things than they do with carrots. Soda is not food. But right now, a tall 5-year-old with a dollar can approach a machine and buy a fizzy beverage equivalent to a cup of coffee with 9 teaspoons of sugar in it. And that's a 12-ounce soda, and no one even sells 12-ounce sodas anymore. Just as tobacco is a nicotine delivery system, soda is a sugar delivery system. And just a few years from now, by 2020, really soon, projections say that obesity-related diseases, diseases caused by soda and things like it, will kill more people than lung cancer. Meanwhile, soda is more popular than water, and we each drink, on average, a quart per day. The amount of soda we drink has doubled since the 50s. And at the same time, our per capita consumption of high fructose corn syrup has gone from 0 per capita to 60 pounds per capita. That's an increase of about 200 calories per person per day, or about 10% of our average intake. So guess what? Our average weight has increased over 20% as a result, because, you know, as you gain weight, it keeps going. If you keep overeating, you keep gaining weight. That's why healthcare professionals talk about a pandemic. I think that added sugar, when we look back 20 to 50 years from now, I think that it's going to be obvious that added sugar was the tobacco of the 21st century. And if you believe that limiting our right to purchase soda is a slippery slope, one that will lead to defining which foods are nutritious and real and which aren't, and which ones government funds should be used to subsidize and which they shouldn't, you're right. It's a slippery slope. It's a slippery slope towards the beginning of a better public health policy. But why do we consume bad substances that aren't food? Why do we consume increasing amounts of them, even when they're proven to cause disease? And why would we allow our children to do so? Because, for example, in the last couple of decades, $1 trillion has been spent on getting us to make the wrong choices in food. $1 billion a year is spent selling soda. Imagine what our public school systems could do with that, $1 billion. Almost nothing is spent encouraging the consumption of fruits and vegetables, and as a result, 1 in 4 meals contains an unprocessed vegetable. I have to say that again. You gotta get it. 1 in 4 meals eaten in the United States contains an unprocessed fruit or vegetable. Now, it would be 1 in 5 meals. That is, it would be worse, except we count the lettuce on a hamburger as an unprocessed vegetable. I swear. This is real research. I write for the New York Times. I have credentials. It's hard to figure out exactly what this means, but my best guess, and the best guess of the people who I do research with and who do research for me, is that maybe 10% of our calories come from unprocessed fruits and vegetables. Now, that explains the obesity pandemic, but it's not just me saying it needs to be different. Lancet has said that 90%, Lancet, the well-respected British medical journal, has said that 90% of our calories ought to come from unprocessed fruits and vegetables. We have to talk about the environment for a minute because, as you know, all of this is not only bad for us, it's bad for the environment. Industrially produced livestock is either the highest or the second highest contributor to atmosphere-altering gases, greenhouse gases, depending on how you count. And global meat production is projected to double in the next 30 years, and there isn't mathematically the land for that to possibly happen. We, when I say we, I mean the United States, kill some 9 billion animals a year, and if you strung them all together, chickens, cows, and pigs, they'd stretch the equivalent of here to the moon and back 5 times. Now that's based on my math, and I'm not a math expert. It could be 4 or 6, but it's up there. The costs of this production of junk food and of industrial livestock are subsidized by us, and they're hidden and they're forestalled. Global warming is one consequence. Water and land and energy shortages are others. And then there's general environmental damage and, of course, the lifestyle diseases we've been talking about. Someone, most likely our children, or if you're young enough, you, is going to pay these costs. You might ask, and I know you would ask if I wasn't addressing this now, because I've given this talk before, you might ask why I'm picking on soda and industrially produced meat. Shouldn't we be worried about the things that make food bad, like fat and sugar and salt? Isn't meat good because it's protein? Everything contains protein, by the way. That's a parenthetical comment. But meat contains a lot of protein, so isn't meat good because it's protein? We need protein. But when you talk that way, it isolates nutrients and it makes things far more complicated than they need to be. It also enables big food to take its hyper-processed junk, load it up with fiber, contend that it's low salt, and sell it to you as healthy. If you wander in the aisles of supermarkets with like aimlessly and just look at stuff, it's mind-blowing. It's really mind-blowing. Industrially produced meat does, of course, provide nutrients. One might even contend that small amounts of it could be a part of a decent diet, except for the damage that treating animals like widgets does to our souls, and except for the damage that it does to our health, and except for the damage that it does to our economy. The bottom line, once again, is this. We need to encourage people to eat real food, discourage them from eating not real food. You can't expect the corporations to see the light. It's not that they're evil, or it's not that they're all totally evil, or at least it's not only because some of them are evil. It's because it's their job to maximize profits now. They have no concern for the grandchildren of their shareholders or anyone else. If a corporation provides jobs while maximizing profits, that's a nice benefit, but it's under no obligation to its shareholders or anyone else to do so. If the corporation pays taxes, that's nice for the rest of us also. It expands the tax base. But if it can avoid doing so, as General Electric did in 2010, then that's within its mission. If the corporation manages to do good while doing well, that's fantastic. But as we all know, that's the exception. So as to the question asked by me a half an hour ago, how do we get corporations under control? The answer is somehow we have to force them. You can't expect them to be moralistic. You have to guilt trip them or boycott them or use other like tactics. When Bettina Siegel, who blogs about school lunches, started a petition online to get pink slime out of kids' foods, the thing went viral, and it worked. I don't know why it worked, but it showed, once again, that we can change things, sometimes without even leaving our homes. We can pressure corporations to do the right thing more often. And we might even be able to get the government to do its job of protecting us by enacting food safety laws, by passing public health regulations, by shoring up defense. And not just defense from imagined foreign threats, but defense from those immoral corporations. The real problem right now, I should say a real problem right now, is getting government to do its job. And its job is to help us make our lives better. The USDA, Department of Agriculture, is a perfect example of this not working. It has two jobs. It's supposed to boost American agriculture, and it's supposed to help us eat well. What's difficult is getting the USDA to do the half of its job that is encouraging us and helping us eat well. But it has no problem with the half of its job that boosts industrial agriculture. It does that brilliantly. It supports the production of processed food at the expense of real food, as evidenced by the subsidies it gives to agribusiness compared to those subsidies almost non-existent, that it gives to what the department calls specialty foods. And what's specialty foods? Fruits and vegetables. It's also evidenced by the USDA's refusal to approve proposals that encourage the definition of food, because that's in part what we need, an acknowledgement that food is nourishment, that encourages, what is it? That it encourages generally good condition. That nourishment sustains us rather than making us ill, and that if a UFO makes you ill, it should not only be not subsidized, it should be disincentivized. So this isn't just about soda, this is about a variety of UFOs, from potato chips to cheeseburgers. As I said before, there's evidence that junk food is addictive. And no one is ever more than a minute or two from being reminded that there's always Coca-Cola and you can have it your way. I'm gonna switch gears for a minute and talk about myself, because I've spent a lot of time talking about things that are not about personal responsibility, because again, I believe there are two solutions here. One is working on the government and corporations to behave better. The other is about taking control of our own lives and eating the way that we probably all know we should be. Defining food is something that you can do for yourself. It's something I had to do for myself. In 27, 5 years ago, I was 40 pounds overweight. No, not when I was 27, sorry. In 2007, I was 40 pounds overweight. I had high cholesterol, I had high blood sugar, I had sleep apnea. I had one knee that was bad enough for surgery, bad enough to cause me to stop running, which was something I'd first taken up in 1973 when I was actually younger than 27. Now, this is a story many middle-aged people could tell you, because this stuff sneaks up on you. And I went to this rather wacky doctor that I know and love and have been going to for more than 30 years. And he said to me, "Easy, you should become a vegan." And I said, "Do you know what I do for a living?" And he said, "You're a smart guy. You figure something out." And the implications of what I figured out will become clear during the rest of the talk. And if one of you asks a question about it, I'll tell that little story. But right now, we don't have time for that. But we have time for other good stuff, so don't worry. So I want to talk about veganism a little bit. Veganism gets a lot of press, both good and bad. But it's also a little bit like nirvana. It's a distant and ideal and almost unachievable goal. Now, there are, I'm sure, vegans in the audience. There are also people who are vegans who don't eat very well. But the point is that an entirely plant-based diet, a diet of unprocessed fruits, vegetables, nuts, legumes, blah, 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 should be one of those things like nirvana where you say the journey is more important than the destination. Because barring catastrophe, at no time in the foreseeable future are enough Americans going to become vegan to make much of a difference. But if we look at veganism as being, so this is one end of the spectrum, this is veganism, and this is Morgan Spurlock's diet, you know, the supersize me guy. Every one of us is in here. Every one of us is in the spectrum between there. And what's important, all that really matters diet-wise, is that we eat more plants and more real foods based on plants, and less meat, less animal products, less hyper-processed junk. All that matters is that we move down this spectrum. You'll note that we're moving from right to left, but that's a coincidence. Now, I want to note a couple of other things. I didn't say don't eat any meat. I didn't say don't eat any hyper-processed junk. I didn't even say don't drink any soda. I didn't say eat local food. I didn't say eat organic food. I didn't say you had to shop at Whole Foods all the time. All I said, and I'll say this as clearly as I possibly can, is that everyone in this room could stand to change the proportions of the things in his or her diet, to move somewhere down that spectrum. This is true of all of us. And this is about a personal food movement, a personal food policy. your policy might be to forego a cheeseburger for a salad once a week, might be to have rice and beans instead of chicken, might be to have oatmeal instead of bacon and eggs, a fruit salad, and so on. It doesn't have to be formal, although it can be. The important thing is to keep moving in the right direction down that spectrum, day by day, month by month. Keep moving. This is what matters. Everybody exercises or says they're going to exercise. And if you have an exercise policy that's, say, I'm going to exercise 5 days a week, and you exercise four, you didn't just blow it. You just didn't meet your perfect goal. And the next week, you can try for five again. This is the same way. You can try to move down this spectrum. You can succeed 3 days in a row and fail on the fourth. You can succeed 3 weeks in a row and fail the fourth, and so on. The important thing is, this is not actually a diet in the sense that for the next 2 weeks I'm going to eat more fruits and vegetables. This is a diet in the sense that this is what you have to eat like. You have to move towards a plant-based diet. And as I said at the very start, we're all going to do that whether we want to or not, but we can do it in a very pretty fashion, or we can do it in a disastrous fashion. So now I think we've looked at the big picture and we've looked at the personal picture. I'd like to look at the things in the middle, the kind of small, achievable things that we can get done in our local societies that we can put pressure on the federal government to do that are not, you know, my highfalutin, nutty ideas that are not really going to happen. What kind of things are achievable in the near future? Let's talk about that. We have to make it much harder to market junk food to kids. That's number one. We have to make it, you're gonna like most of these, so you could save your applause for them. I'm not gonna say, you know, we have to be giving out free heroin on every street corner. It's all good stuff. I thought about this a lot. We have to make it harder to market junk food to kids. The internet thing is really huge. Just to think about that a little bit, and those of you who are parents of young kids, look at that and think how serious and how terrible that is, because it's really bad. We have to make it illegal, I really think illegal, to sell and market soda to kids. And we certainly have to stop dispensing it in schools. We have to ban vending machines from schools. As of 2004, there were vending machines in almost every high school in the country. And we have to allow fewer vending machines elsewhere, or there is a novel idea, which is the vending machine that dispenses real food. We need to tax soda as we do cigarettes, and we need to demonize bad food the way that we demonized cigarettes. We need to subsidize the production and sale and purchase of real food, especially fruits and vegetables. We need more farmers. We need more small and medium-sized farms. We need fewer people growing 2,000 acres of corn. We also need to work together to demonize bad food and encourage the consumption of good food. We have to lead by example. And we have to say to our friends and our loved ones, you changed your light bulbs. How about eating a freaking salad? We need, and this is an important one, we need to fix labeling. Labeling needs to be honest. We need to subsidize farmers' markets. We need to subsidize indoor city markets. We need to subsidize direct sale by farmers, fishers, and even hunters. We need, as I said at the beginning, to provide incentives for people to eat better and disincentives for them to eat worse. Chocolate chip cookies should cost $2. Apples should cost a dime. Soda should cost $4. Water should be free. Cheeseburgers should cost $4. Salads should cost $1. And I said this four times now. We have to subsidize traditional, progressive food ways and desubsidize those that produce non-food. If we do this, we become leaders in the worldwide food movement. We, the United States of America. Right now, it's going to be Australia that becomes the leader in this food movement, or Scandinavia. But we can become this leader. But even if we can't do this, if we can't get soda tax passed, if we can't eliminate corporate subsidies, if we can't fix school lunches, which, by the way, we have to, if we can't help poor people eat better, we can still, you and I, can still set an example by moving towards a plant-heavy diet. We can move down that spectrum, and we can begin to eat like people of earlier generations and avoid eating like real Americans. We can move from getting 10% of our calories from fresh fruits and vegetables towards getting 90%. We can also try to act like a real society, an organization for mutual benefit. We have, I think, a moral obligation to one another, to move from a consumer-driven society, a profit-driven society, to one in which we assume responsibility for determining how to help other people think sustainably, how to help people shop and cook, and how to help them eat in a way that was once taken for granted, sanely, in tune with tradition and the planet's resources. As I said at the start, 50 or at the most 100 years from now, we're all going to be eating a mostly plant-based diet. Whether that happens through catastrophe or in a peaceful, sustainable, life-giving way is determined by the choices that we make right now and the way that we fight together. Thank you.
That was Mark Bittman, who spoke in Portland in 2012. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for The Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any other talk in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Crystal Liguori produces The Archive Project for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community without whom this show would not be possible. The music for The Archive Project is by Emancipator. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of The Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.